You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Just a quick announcement. I'm trying to grow our listenership, so I hope you'll share Kick-Ass News with two of your friends this week, or better yet, share it with all of your friends on your social media. And if you'd like to pitch in and become a part of what I'm doing here, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews. Whatever you can do to support the podcast is appreciated, and it shows me that you value this little show that I put out every week. Thanks for listening, and now, enjoy the podcast. I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. At the height of the Korean War, President Harry S. Truman committed a gaffe that sent shockwaves around the world. When asked by a reporter about the possible use of atomic weapons in response to China's entry into the war, Truman replied testily, "The military commander in the field will have charge of the use of the weapons, as he always has." This suggested that General Douglas MacArthur, the willful, fearless, and highly decorated commander of the American and U.S. forces, had his finger on the nuclear trigger. A correction quickly followed, but the damage was done. Two visions for America's path forward were clearly in opposition, and one man would have to make way. Truman was one of the most unpopular presidents in American history. Heir to a struggling economy, a ruined Europe, and increasing tension with the Soviet Union, on no issue was the path ahead clear and easy. General MacArthur, on the other hand, was incredibly popular, as untouchable as any officer has ever been in America. The lessons he drew from World War II were absolute. Appeasement leads to disaster, and a showdown with the Soviets was inevitable. The sooner the better. In the nuclear era, when the Soviets too had the bomb, the specter of a catastrophic Third World War lurked menacingly close on the horizon. The contest of wills between these two titanic characters unfolds against the turbulent backdrop of a faraway war and terrors conjured at home by Joseph McCarthy. From the drama of Stalin's blockade of West Berlin to the daring landing of MacArthur's forces at Incheon to the shocking entrance of China into the war, a new book called The General Versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War, vividly evokes the making of a new American era. And today, the author of the book, acclaimed historian and master storyteller H.W. Brands, joins me on the show to talk about it. He holds the Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas at Austin, where he teaches history and writing. He's the author of 32 books, including Reagan, The Man Who Saved the Union, Traitor to His Class, Andrew Jackson, The Age of Gold, The First American, and T.R. Several of his books have been New York Times bestsellers, and two, Traitor to His Class and The First American, were finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. Brands is passionate about getting kids interested in history, and he's written several acclaimed textbooks like American Stories, A History of the United States, which reflects his view that history should be taught through stories. You'll also recognize him from his frequent appearances in documentaries for the History Channel, including the miniseries The Presidents, 10 Days That Unexpectedly Changed America, America, the Story of Us, and the Men Who Built America. And on top of all that, for the past 4 years, he's been writing a history of the United States in haiku form and publishing it on Twitter. Today, he's coming on the show to talk about one of the all-time great rivalries in history between President Harry S. Truman and the man with the corncob pipe, General Douglas MacArthur. H.W. Brands will reveal how woefully unprepared the U.S. military was after World War II, just how close America got to nuclear war with China and the Soviets, and the significance of the Korean War as the first real test of the newly formed United Nations. He'll discuss why taking a stand in the Korean Peninsula was important to Truman and why he wanted MacArthur to win, but not win too much. He'll talk about how MacArthur became a hero to the conquered Japanese following World War II, the many ways he subtly and not so subtly snubbed his commander-in-chief, and why MacArthur's own attempt at running for president ended in disaster. Plus, how the Korean conflict set an unfortunate precedent for Truman's successors in the White House, Donald Trump's obsession with Douglas MacArthur, and whether or not the old general would be the kind of guy we'd want to be running our military today. Coming up with author and historian H.W. Brands in just a moment. Today I'm talking with historian and master storyteller H.W. Brands. He's the Dickinson Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of 32 books, including Andrew Jackson, The Age of Gold, and TR, as well as Traitor to His Class and The First American, which were both finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. He has a brand new book about one of the great rivalries in history. It's called The General Versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. H.W. Brands, thanks for joining me over the phone.
Delighted to be with you, Ben.
Well, I loved this book. Anyone will tell you that you had to pry it out of my hands over the past week here, and you have such a great gift for storytelling. First, set the scene for us. What were Truman and MacArthur's standing in the world in 1950?
So when the Korean War began in June of 1950, Douglas MacArthur was perhaps the most celebrated of American military heroes. He had covered himself with valor and medals in World War I, in World War II. In World War II, he had been the supreme commander of Allied forces in the Southwestern Pacific. He had been the one most responsible for the American victory over Japan. He, after the war, was appointed to head up the American occupation of Japan. And in that position, he became a de facto emperor. And he did something that, as far as I can tell, no one else in human history has ever done. He almost single-handedly transformed a great power, a great country, a great culture from one that emphasized militarism to one that revered, that adored an emperor, to one that was utterly anti-democratic, that kept women subordinate. He modernized it, he liberalized it, and he did this all in a way that made the Japanese people revere him. They had revered the emperor before. They revered MacArthur. It was a brilliant action of administration. No one, certainly no American, had ever done anything like it. So in 1950, MacArthur is one of the great heroes, one of the great celebrities of American public affairs. Harry Truman was president of the United States, but he was very unlikely president of the United States. He was actually even an unlikely vice president. He was added to the Roosevelt ticket, Franklin Roosevelt's ticket in 1944, primarily because Democrats revolted against the sitting vice president, Henry Wallace. No one expected Truman to be president. No one expected much out of him after he suddenly became president upon Roosevelt's death in April of 1945. Truman himself was flummoxed and flabbergasted. And he told reporters, he said, "Boys, I don't know if you pray, but if you do, pray for me because I'm going to need it." One of his first actions as president was to try to talk Dwight Eisenhower, the commander of American forces in Europe at the end of World War II, into running for president on the Democratic ticket in 1948, replacing him. And he said, I will step aside and I will help you get the Democratic nomination to become president. But he gradually grew into the job, became more self-confident. He ran for election in his own right in 1948, and he surprised everybody, including the Republicans, by winning. And he put the United States on a course that would lead to the policy of containment in the Cold War, not directly fighting the communists in the Cold War, but trying to contain their expansion. So at the beginning of 1949, at the beginning of 1950, Truman is president in his own right. He has this policy of containment in mind, strongly criticized by Republicans, many of whom are fans of Douglas MacArthur, because the communists have just gained control of China. And as the Republicans, including Joseph McCarthy, who's riding high at this moment, say, Truman lost China to the communists. So it's at this moment that the Korean War breaks out. The Korean War, in a nutshell, is communists of North Korea attack into anti-communist South Korea. And Truman, the president of the United States, has to decide how to respond. And his decision will be implemented by Douglas MacArthur, who is the commander of American forces in the Far East, based in Tokyo.
Yeah, and you know, one of the key things that might stick out in the minds of those of us who learned about the Korean War in the high school history books was the 38th parallel. But the division of North and South Korea was apparently only supposed to be a temporary thing, right?
Exactly. And the fact that it was the 38th parallel was just a matter of happenstance. It turns out just a couple of days ago, I was in Washington, and I was speaking at a bookstore in Washington. And after the event and after my talk, a man comes up to me who looked kind of vaguely familiar from a figure that I knew from history. And he identified himself as David Rusk, the son of Dean Rusk, who would become Secretary of State. But Dean Rusk was in the State Department. He was connected to the military in 1945, at the end of World War II. And Rusk was tasked with figuring out how Japanese forces in Korea should have their surrenders taken. And the Soviets had occupied the northern part of Korea, and American forces had occupied the southern part of Korea. And they had to figure out, okay, so where are we going to divide this up, where the Soviets will accept the surrender of Japanese forces in the north and Americans in the south? And Rusk, Dean Rusk, and this other guy, they get out this old National Geographic map of Korea. And they look and they see, okay, oh, here, look, the 38th parallel runs kind of right across the middle of Korea. So why don't we say that's the dividing line? And they did this just on the spur of the moment, and everyone assumed that this would be simply temporary, a de facto division to keep the American troops from bumping up against the Soviet troops. But surely this line would be erased in short order when there was this post-war peace conference and the future of Korea was determined. Well, the 38th parallel actually became fairly permanent over the next few years, and it became this dividing line between communist North Korea and anti-communist South Korea.
You say that Korea was not strategically important to the U.S., but for Truman, making a stand in the Korean Peninsula served both a political and a diplomatic purpose. What were those about?
Most definitely. So in 1949, Harry Truman broke with tradition in American history and politics that dated all the way back to George Washington. Truman signed the North Atlantic Treaty, America's first peacetime alliance. And the essence of that alliance, in any alliance, is the credibility of America's promise. The United States has promised to go to the defense of the countries, the other countries of NATO. Truman has also said, in what came to be called the Truman Doctrine, that the United States would defend countries that were challenged by communist infiltration or aggression. So the members of NATO are watching the President of the United States, who has promised them if they are attacked, the U.S. will come to their defense. They're watching when the communists from North Korea attack South Korea. And will President Truman stand up to this communist offensive? So Korea itself, not particularly strategically important. The United States had evacuated its forces. The Soviets had evacuated their forces the previous year. But now it assumes this political and diplomatic importance. Will the United States live up to its promises in general? And Truman made the decision, we have to defend South Korea, because if we don't, we cannot defend Europe.
And what was the end game in Korea from MacArthur's perspective?
MacArthur took a very different view. MacArthur had always been a theater commander rather than someone with a global view. This had been the case in World War I, definitely the case in World War II. And he suffered from, I guess also say benefited from, something that tends to influence theater commanders. They tend to think that their theater is the most important theater of the world. And MacArthur was notorious for this during World War II. He would constantly harangue and harass Washington to say, we need more resources in the Pacific. Quit sending so many troops and so many supplies to Europe, because the Pacific is the important place. Well, when he is in Korea, when he's in East Asia, he begins to think that this is where the Cold War will be won or lost. MacArthur was also from that old school of the military that believed that peace is peace, and war is war. And if you're going to go to war all out. Harry Truman wanted to keep World War III from breaking out. Douglas MacArthur believed that World War III had already begun, and it was being fought in Asia, starting in Korea.
Was America's military in any position to fight a third world war at that point?
This was a very delicate issue, and neither MacArthur, nor the President of the United States, nor his administration were fully leveling with the American people for the very good reason that they didn't want to tip their hand to the Soviets. The United States in 1945, most Americans expected that the country would demobilize as it had after every previous war. There were 16
right.
million Americans under arms at the end of the war, and they all wanted to go home. They didn't want to stick around in the military. And there was this expectation. But then, and in fact, the mobilization largely took place. Nearly all of the troops were mustered out. They went back to their civilian occupations. But then the Cold War developed, and the United States found itself in competition with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union never demobilized, so it always had this large army. And the United States began to build up its army once again. But it was an unpopular thing to do, because Americans who had served during World War II, they said, we did our turn. We don't want to go back into war. You know, and there's not a war going on, so why should you have us in the military? So it was very difficult and a painstaking process for the United States to rebuild its military. Now, one thing it did have in its advantage was it had the atom bomb at a time when
right.
nobody else did. But then, in 1949, the Soviets developed the atom bomb. And so the United States, from 45 to 49, had been thinking, okay, if war breaks out in Europe, we don't have as many troops and as many tanks as the Soviets do, but we do have the atom bomb. And so that will stop them. But as of 1949, the Soviets had the atom bomb. And so the United States found itself in 1950 not in a position to take the Soviets on in a major war, because the Soviets could neutralize America's nuclear advantage, and the United States could not match the Soviets' advantage of conventional weapons. MacArthur refused to believe that this was decisive. MacArthur thought that, okay, if we expand the war in East Asia, if we go after China, that's not going to bring the Soviets into war against the United States. Truman said, I cannot take that risk. We might go to war against China in Asia, but the Soviets might very well take the opportunity to attack us in Europe, and we do not have the troops to fight. Not now. Truman began a big, rapid buildup of American military force, and he said, we have to at least delay this confrontation with the Soviets till 1953 or so. Then we might be able to hold them off. There's another angle here, and that is Truman was the only man in world history, he remains the only man in world history, to have ordered the use of nuclear weapons during wartime against Japan in 1945. So he bore this special responsibility. It was one thing for Douglas MacArthur to recommend policies that might lead to the use of nuclear weapons, but Truman was the one who was going to have to give the order. He had done it once before. And though he said he never lost any sleep over it, he didn't certainly lightly want to do it again.
You mentioned that this was the first time that a president went to the UN instead of asking for Congress to give him a declaration of war. Was this in some ways the first real test of the United Nations?
It was, and it was a matter of dumb luck that the United States was able to get the United Nations on its side. The luck was that the Soviet delegate to the Security Council was boycotting the meetings of the Security Council in protest of America's refusal to accept the seating of the delegate from the new communist government of China. The Security Council is the one that makes the really substantive decisions. And on the Security Council, the five charter members, including the United States and the Soviet Union, have veto power. So every other thing that the United States wanted to do until then could be vetoed by the Soviet Union, and often was. But the Soviet delegate was missing that day. And he wasn't there, so he couldn't veto. So the Security Council took the American proposal to recommend that members of the United Nations unite in support of the defense of South Korea. So it was a coup for the United States. It made America's promise that the UN was going to help secure world stability was going to pay off, finally. And so the United States went to war in Korea, that is, in the defense of South Korea, with the blessing of the United Nations. The Soviet delegate quickly returned to UN headquarters and was able to veto any other decisions by the Security Council, but this one authorizing resolution was the one under which the war was fought. And so Truman is able to say, the UN is on our side. Our bet on the United Nations is paying off. Furthermore, Douglas MacArthur was not simply the American commander in South Korea. He was the United Nations commander in South Korea.
Yeah, and what were his explicit orders?
Part of the problem was that MacArthur rarely got explicit orders. And this because MacArthur outranked all of his military superiors. He was a 5-star general. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Omar Bradley, just had 4 stars. The other staff chiefs, they only had 4 stars. Now, in the chain of command, they were above him. But in terms of prestige in the military, they were below him. And MacArthur was quite willing to play on that differential in his favor. And so the Joint Chiefs were very reluctant to order MacArthur to do anything. And the reason for this was because one of Omar Bradley's subordinates was asked, well, why can't you just order MacArthur to do this, that, or the other thing? He says, well, because they'll probably disobey the order, and then what are we going to do? The problem was that MacArthur seemed to be untouchable. He certainly seemed, in the minds of most Americans, to outrank the President of the United States. Harry Truman's military experience, he was a captain of artillery during World War I. That was it. Douglas MacArthur was a 5-star general who commanded armies across entire oceans. So who was Truman to tell MacArthur what to do? And the Joint Chiefs figured if the president can't tell him what to do, we can't either. And this is one of the things that led to the crisis between Truman and MacArthur, because the Joint Chiefs would never give MacArthur an explicit order, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. They would give him suggestions. And MacArthur had enough confidence and own judgment to say, okay, like me use my judgment, I'm going to do it. And he did what he wanted, even to the point of conducting diplomacy on his own. And that's finally where he crossed the line. But there was a lot before he got there that Truman had to put up with.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with author-historian H.W. Brands when we come back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with H.W. Brands, you should check out The General versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War, by my guest today, best-selling author H.W. Brands. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be The General versus the President by H.W. Brands or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. Going back to the beginning of it, the North Koreans were on the verge of overrunning South Korea when MacArthur came up with a pretty daring gambit to gain a foothold on the peninsula. What was his plan, and what did Truman and the Joint Chiefs think of it?
MacArthur had this idea that he would circle around behind the lines of the North Koreans and conduct a landing at Incheon, which is a port city near Seoul. It was far behind the lines at that point. And his thinking was that they would never expect this. They hadn't defended Incheon. The reason they hadn't defended Incheon was that the approaches to Incheon were very narrow and treacherous. It has some of the highest tides in the world. So an amphibious force trying to land there had about a 2-hour window where they had to get everybody on shore, and they have to establish a foothold before the tide runs out and leaves the landing craft stranded on these mud flats and easy pickings for artillery that would just bombard them to smithereens. And the Joint Chiefs were skeptical. All of MacArthur's military advisors were skeptical. Truman was skeptical. But no one would say, no, you can't do it, because MacArthur insisted that I can do it, and precisely because it's so daring and so risky, that's what's going to make it successful. And the Joint Chiefs said basically among themselves, all right, we will let MacArthur do this, but they created enough of a paper trail so that if it failed, the blame would be on MacArthur and not on them. And they were in a position where basically they said, okay, let MacArthur hang himself. Well, against all expectation, this offensive succeeded brilliantly. And MacArthur is now riding higher than ever. No one can tell MacArthur what to do because those people, the naysayers, they were proved wrong. MacArthur had a severe case of hubris, and this simply increased this. He believed that he knew better than everybody else what was possible, what he could accomplish, because time after time in the past, he had been told, you can't do that, you can't do that. And each time he did it, and he succeeded. And so eventually he's come to a point where he's going to tell the President of the United States what to do. And the question is, what's the President of the United States going to do in response to that?
At what point did MacArthur go from driving the North Koreans back over the 38th to crossing the 38th parallel and going on the offensive?
The UN Security Council resolution authorized the United States and the other countries going to the defense of South Korea simply to repel the invading force, to restore the boundary at the 38th parallel. It did not authorize the United States or anybody else to go to invade North Korea. But Truman could not resist the opportunity because MacArthur, with that landing at Incheon, nearly destroyed the North Korean army, nearly had most of them captured. And those who weren't captured raced to the north, and they were on the run, and they would be easy prey for follow-up forces, South Koreans and North Koreans. And MacArthur urged the president to give him authority to go north, and Truman having been castigated by Republicans for losing China, thought, okay, now I can do something no president has ever done. I can actually roll back communist control. So since 1945, the communists had never lost territory. And Truman imagined, okay, I'm going to win back North Korea. And so he gave MacArthur the go-ahead, and go ahead and invade North Korea. But there was some question as to what MacArthur should do if he got close to the border with China, because the Chinese began warning the United States indirectly, if American forces come close to the border, we will have to respond. The Chinese were quite fearful that the United States would reopen the Chinese Civil War. A strong contingent in Congress among the Republicans had been advocating the term was to unleash Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Chinese nationalists, and to send him back to the mainland to overthrow the communists. And there were lots of people in the American government who were saying that's what we ought to do. And so the Chinese quite naturally would think if an American army is approaching the Chinese border, they might have to worry about an invasion of China. So the Chinese said to the Americans indirectly, if you come close to the border, we might have to take action. MacArthur dismissed this. Harry Truman flew all the way to Wake Island, flew 14,000 miles to meet Douglas MacArthur, who flew just 2,000 miles from Tokyo to meet him, and asked MacArthur point blank, will the Chinese enter the war? And MacArthur said they won't dare, and if they do, they will be annihilated. So Truman, thinking MacArthur presumably knew what he was talking about, went home reassured. MacArthur was never given explicit orders to keep American troops away from the border. There was a suggestion, a directive as a matter of policy, as the phrasing went, from the Joint Chiefs, to use South Korean troops up in the border regions rather than American troops. Well, a mere suggestion was not enough to deter MacArthur, so MacArthur sent American troops right up to the border. The Chinese responded as they had warned they would. They infiltrated 250,000 troops into North Korea when they launched a surprise attack on MacArthur and manhandled American and South Korean forces and forced the Americans to fall back. It was the critical moment of the war, and it looked as though all the gains that had been made since the Incheon landing would be undone. American forces had to, basically, they raced back toward the 38th parallel and were pushed back into South Korea. It's at this point when MacArthur most clearly and loudly agitates for permission to take the war directly to China, using nuclear weapons if necessary. And he goes increasingly public with his criticism of the President of the United States, his commander-in-chief, for refusing to allow him to do that.
And was that the straw that broke the camel's back? What was it that did it for Truman where he decided that MacArthur had to go?
It was a series of events that built up to a climax. MacArthur repeatedly said, we need to bring the Chinese nationalists into this war. And Truman had said, we're not bringing the Chinese nationalists in. We want to keep the Korean issue separate from relations with China. So shut up about the Chinese nationalists. He had agitated for the right to bomb into China from air bases in Japan and in South Korea. And Truman said, there's no bombing of China, so shut up about that. And then the final straw was when a leader of Republicans in the House of Representatives, Joseph Martin, who was the Republican leader there, gave this rip-roaring speech, tearing into Truman for insufficient attention to American security, for subverting the Constitution. It was a very bitterly partisan campaign speech. And Martin sent a copy of the speech to MacArthur, saying, General, I gave this speech. You might want to read it. And MacArthur writes back congratulating Martin on his statesmanship, on his insight into policy, in what is seen as an obvious endorsement of this bitter attack on Truman. So MacArthur essentially has lined himself up with the Republicans against the president. And when this letter was made public, and MacArthur later claimed that he didn't know it was going to be made public. Well, MacArthur was far too smart for that. If he had not wanted it to be made public, he very easily could have said at the beginning of the letter, this is for your eyes only, but he didn't. And so he understood that, Martin was going to publish this letter, and MacArthur and Martin did. At that point, Truman decided it wasn't so much that Truman was angry at MacArthur for this partisanship. The bigger issue was that the world was getting confused as to what American policy was. Who makes the decisions for the United States? Is it the President of the United States who has one idea, keep the war in Korea limited, or is it this general, Doug MacArthur, who is continually saying we've got to expand the war? And it was this confusion, especially now that the world had two nuclear superpowers. The Soviets had gotten the atom bomb just several months before. And so Truman believes that it's essential to the safety of the world as well as American security that the United States speak with one voice. And MacArthur refused to acknowledge that that voice would be the voice of the president. That's when Truman decided MacArthur had to be fired.
Some would say that MacArthur wanted to be fired so that he could come back home and openly campaign for the 1952 nomination. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there were some suspicions within the Truman administration that MacArthur had set himself up to be fired precisely so he could come home to the victory celebration he got when he came home, and that he could launch a campaign for the presidency, as he did in giving a widely noted speech before a joint session of the House and the Senate. And he did, in fact, run for president. So Truman had an idea that he was probably going to run for president. And so he launched this campaign for the presidency. And one of the things that galled Truman was, he thought MacArthur had a right to run for president if he wanted to, but he really thought that he ought to take off his military uniform, because he was still collecting his pay as a five-star general. And he was parading around the country as though he was speaking for the armed forces of America. Well, he was not, but nonetheless, he got a lot of encouragement precisely because he still played the role of this military hero. But Truman turned out to have a better sense of American political opinion. And Truman just kept his mouth shut. And he figured that MacArthur would eventually say too much.
And MacArthur really came back to a hero's welcome, because he had a huge ticker tape parade. And I think it was the speech to the joint session of Congress where he made that famous remark, an old soldier never dies, he just fades away, right?
That's what he said. That's the way he closed his speech. But the great irony was that he didn't intend to fade away at all. He was going to launch a campaign for president, which he did. But he made a couple of fatal missteps. And one was that he interpreted the celebration for his homecoming as an endorsement of his policies against that of President Truman. In fact, the people were celebrating him, congratulating him for his role in World War II. This was the homecoming of the war hero, not the candidate for president. And he had really lost touch with the changes in American political culture. He didn't realize that the authoritarian personality that he had. He was a great emperor of Japan. But Americans don't elect emperors, they elect presidents. And what he didn't realize that was that there was this other general, another World War II hero, who did have a much better sense of the American political culture, had a much defter common touch, who was going to run for president, and that was Dwight Eisenhower. And this really galled MacArthur, because Eisenhower had been MacArthur's adjutant, his subordinate. And MacArthur didn't think highly, really, of anybody, but he didn't think particularly highly of Dwight Eisenhower. And so when Americans turned their attention favorably toward Eisenhower and against MacArthur, it left MacArthur just sort of out in the cold, gnashing his teeth.
And I suppose it would take many decades for Truman, for his reputation to rehabilitate.
Oh, this is a great part of the story. And it's something that gives hope to presidents who leave office under a cloud. Because when Truman left office, he was the most unpopular president in American history, before or after, as measured by popular approval ratings. And through the 1950s, his reputation remained in the basement. It rose a little bit during the Vietnam War, when Americans learned that there were worse outcomes to a war in Asia than the Korean stalemate. The United States might actually lose a war, as it did in Vietnam. But Truman's reputation was not definitively rehabilitated until the end of the Cold War, until 40 years after the events in Korea. Truman's decision to fire MacArthur basically was Truman's suicide note. It meant that he couldn't run, he couldn't be elected president again, and he would be relegated to the realms of terrible presidents. But during the 1980s, in the early 1990s, when the Cold War ended, on America's terms, on Truman's terms, then people began to realize, you know, back in 1950, we were fairly evenly divided whether MacArthur's go at him with everything was the right approach or Truman's patient resolve was the right approach. Now, the Cold War is over. There has been no World War III, and we won the Cold War. You know, that Harry Truman, he was right. So this is one case where history, belatedly, vindicated Harry Truman. And other presidents, Lyndon Johnson after Vietnam, George W. Bush after the invasion of Iraq, you know, they can hope that history vindicates them too. We'll see. But it certainly did in the case of Harry Truman.
Yeah, you've often said that Americans make too big of a deal of the presidency, and I feel like Truman is perhaps the perfect example of this fact that for all the ruffles and flourishes, the president is still a regular guy. He's only one man, and, you know, Truman, I always like to think of Truman as kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of presidents. It's like he got no respect, not even at home. You know, even his wife and his mother-in-law still treated him like a bum when he was president of the United States.
Yeah, and that long story, it plays into exactly what you're talking about, where he's even the underdog when he leaves the White House. He's the underdog for two decades afterwards. But finally, people realize that this ordinary, plain-spoken Harry of Independence, Missouri, he's the one America needed, even though they didn't realize it at the time. So this is for everybody out there whose career is not doing what they want, whose life isn't living up to their expectations. They can hope that, you know, if we wait long enough, then we'll see that I was right. So for those people who are hoping that when time passes, their actions are going to look better, they can look to Harry Truman and say, he's my guy.
Yeah, a lot has been made of the Cuban Missile Crisis as the closest we ever came to nuclear war. But there was a real fear that this police action was going to spill over into a World War III. How close, in your opinion, were we to World War III and maybe even a nuclear war?
Well, in some ways, I think we were closer than during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The crisis of 1950 and 1951 is often overlooked because it wasn't this televised mano a mano between the President of the United States and the leader of the Soviet Union. But the United States, the world, was very close to a nuclear war. But the irony is that the struggle took place not between the United States government and another government, but within the United States government. If Douglas MacArthur had had his way, the United States would have bombed China and might very well, and probably would have escalated to nuclear weapons. China had just signed a treaty of alliance with the Soviet Union, which had just developed nuclear weapons. The Soviets had credibility issues of their own. They could not afford to see one of their allies beaten up on by the United States. So if the United States went nuclear against China, the Soviets would probably have to go nuclear against, maybe not against the continental United States, but against American forces, say, in Germany. Mm-hmm. And once the nukes started flying, that would have been World War III. So I happen to think that quite arguably, the world was closer to World War III in 1950 than it was even in 1962.
Wow.
And so if Truman had decided otherwise, that could have been, that if he had given MacArthur his head, then that very easily could have been World War III.
Wow. Well, before we go, we're recording this the day after the final presidential debate. Last night, Donald Trump once again invoked General MacArthur. Given what we face with Russia, Syria, Iran, and once again North Korea, is MacArthur the kind of man that you would want to be dealing with our geopolitical adversaries in this day and age?
I certainly would not want him. But the lasting appeal of Douglas MacArthur lies in a statement that he made, that in war there is no substitute for victory. Americans are often frustrated, they have been since the Korean War, that we have been beset by enemies and we cannot use the full power of our military arsenal against them. What MacArthur was saying in 1950, 1951 is we should use the full power. But the problem with that is it risks a nuclear war that will blow up the whole world. And so we live in this time of frustration, and the frustrations are essentially inevitable. There's no way around them unless you really want to fight World War III, as most people don't. But the frustrations remain, and MacArthur is the antidote, or at least seems the antidote to those frustrations. We wish we could do what MacArthur advocated, even though we know we shouldn't.
Now, do you know what your next book is going to be?
I'm jumping back to the 19th century. I have gone between earlier times and the 20th century. And I'm going to look not at a president exactly, but at, well, in the 19th century, the heroes of American politics were members of the Senate. So I'm looking at three great senators from the early 19th century, Henry Clay, John Calhoun, and Daniel Webster. These were the rock stars of their time.
Yeah.
And their story really basically tells the story of America in the first half of the 19th century.
Great. Well, I look forward to it, and I hope you'll come back on when it comes out.
Okay.
Once again, the book is called The General Versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. It is a terrific read. It reads like a novel. H.W. Brands, thanks for talking with me.
My pleasure. Delighted.
Thanks again to H.W. Brands for joining me on the podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, then you can order his book, The General Versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. It's available on Amazon, or you can download the audio version of his book for free through that special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Keep up with H.W. Brands on his website at hwbrands.com and follow him on Twitter at @HWBrands. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.